their allies across the Atlantic. But stores of munitions and clothing preserved the Patriot cause from collapse. In June, the world conflict spread and deepened, and another European power entered the struggle. French diplomacy brought Spain into the war. Britain was still further weakened, her naval communications in the Mediterranean were imperiled, and within a few months, Gibraltar was besieged. In the New World, she was forced to keep watch against a Spanish incursion into Florida, and American privateers based on the port of New Orleans harassed English commerce in the Caribbean. In European waters, one of these privateers provided a colourful episode. An American captain of Scottish birth, named John Paul Jones, was supplied by the French with an ancient East India merchantman, which he converted in French dockyards into a man-of-war. It was named the Bonhomme Richard, and in September, Captain Jones, with a polyglot crew and in company with three smaller vessels, sailed his memorable craft into the North Sea. Off Flamborough Head, he intercepted a convoy of merchantmen from the Baltic and straightaway attacked the English escorts, the men of war Serapis and Scarborough. The merchant ships escaped, and on the evening of the 23rd, battle commenced between the Serapis and the Bonhomme Richard. The English vessel was superior in construction, equipment, and guns, but Jones maneuvered his vessel alongside and lashed himself to his adversary. Throughout the night, the two vessels rocked together, the muzzles of their guns almost touching, mauling each other with broadsides, musketry volleys, and hand grenades. At times, both ships were on fire. Jones's three smaller vessels circled the inferno, firing broadsides into both ships. The English and American captains fought grimly on. At last, towards dawn, there was a violent explosion in the powder magazine of the Serapis. Her guns were wrecked, and all abaft the mainmast were killed. The English were forced to surrender. But the Bonhomme Richard was so shattered that she sank 2 days later. The encounter made a lively stir in French and American society, and Jones became a hero. All this time, Washington's army had remained incapable of action. They could do little except keep watch on Clinton. Simply to have kept his army in existence during these years was probably Washington's greatest contribution to the Patriot cause. No other American leader could have done as much. In December, Clinton decided to try his hand once more at subduing the South. He resolved to capture Charleston, and on the 26th, having learned that the French fleet in the West Indies had been beaten by Admiral Rodney, he sailed for South Carolina with 8,000 men. For a time, he prospered. Bad weather delayed him, and the main siege did not begin till the end of March, but in May 1780, the town fell, and 5,000 Patriot troops surrendered in the biggest disaster yet sustained by American arms. Then fortune began to turn against Clinton. He'd gained a valuable base, but he was confronted with civil war. He found himself faced not with a regular army in the field, but with innumerable guerrilla bands which harassed his communications and murdered loyalists. It became evident that a huge army would be needed to occupy and subdue the country. But again, sea power intervened. Rumours that French troops were once more crossing the Atlantic made Clinton hasten back to New York, leaving Cornwallis, his second in command, to do the best he could in the South. This was little enough. Washington sent a small force against him under Gates, the victor of Saratoga. Cornwallis defeated Gates at the Battle of Camden and marched into North Carolina, routing the guerrillas as he went, but the countryside rose in arms behind him. There was no crucial point he could strike at, and the only effect of his exertions was the destruction of a quantity of crops which the rebels might have traded to Europe for munitions. In the North, Clinton, for the second time, found himself in great peril. Another fleet had indeed arrived from France, and this time he was too late to forestall a landing. Over 5,000 French troops under the Comte de Rochambeau had disembarked in July at Newport in Rhode Island. Washington, vigilant and alert, was encamped at White Plains in the Hudson Valley. Benedict Arnold, who'd led the expedition to Canada in 1776 and fought with distinction at Saratoga, commanded the fort at West Point. At any moment, the French might advance inland from the coast and join him. New York, Clinton's base and harbour, seemed lost. But events, in the form of treachery, ran for a time with the British. Arnold had long been dissatisfied with the conduct of the Patriots, and he'd recently married a Loyalist lady. He was in debt, and he had lately been reprimanded by court-martial for misappropriating government property. His discontent and his doubts were deepened by the news of Gates's defeat at Camden, and he now offered to surrender West Point to Clinton for the sum of £20,000. Its loss would not only destroy Washington's grip on the Hudson Valley, but might ruin the whole Patriot power. Clinton seized on the conspiracy as the one chance of retrieving his position in the North, and sent a young major named André in disguise to arrange the details of the capitulation. On September the 21st, 1780, André sailed up the Hudson in a sloop and met Arnold late at night on the west shore not far from Stony Point. Here Arnold gave him written descriptions of the forts, their armaments and stores, the strength of the garrisons, copies of their orders in case of attack, and copies of the proceedings of a council of war recently held at West Point. On his way back across the no-man's land between the two armies, André fell into the hands of some irregular scouts and was delivered to the nearest American commander. The documents were found in his boots. The commander could not believe in Arnold's treachery, and a request for an explanation was sent to West Point. Arnold escaped, followed by his wife, and was rewarded with a general's commission in King George's service and the command of a British force. He died in disgrace and poverty 20 years after. André was executed as a spy. He wrote a graceful and dignified letter to Washington, asking to be shot instead of hanged. In vain. He was a young man of great personal beauty, and in his scarlet uniform, standing upon the gallows and himself arranging the noose around his neck, he made an appealing sight. His courage reduced to tears the rough crowd that had gathered to see him die. In all the anger of the struggle, with the exasperation of Arnold's desertion hardening every patriot heart, no one could be found to perform the task of executioner, and in the end a nameless figure, with his face blackened as a disguise, did the work. 40 years later, André was reburied in Westminster Abbey. Arnold's act of betrayal, though discovered in time, had a marked, if temporary, effect on the sentiment and cohesion of the Patriots. They had been very near disaster. Many Americans were strongly opposed to the war, and Loyalists throughout the country either openly or secretly supported the British. The South was already smitten with hideous civil strife, in which American slew American, and each man suspected his neighbour. Was the same frightful process to engulf the North, hitherto steadfast in the Patriot cause? If the commander of West Point was a traitor, then who could be trusted? These anxieties and fears were deepened by a reversal of the Patriot fortunes at sea. Admiral Rodney arrived before New York with a substantial fleet and blockaded the French in Newport till the end of the campaigning season. Then he struck again, this time in the West Indies, where the Dutch had been making large fortunes by shipping arms and powder to the Patriots. The centre of their trade was St. Eustatius in the Leeward Islands. In the autumn, news came that Holland had joined the coalition against Great Britain, and Rodney was ordered to seize the island. This he did early in 1781, and a large store of munitions and merchandise consigned to General Washington fell into the hands of the British fleet. Strategic divergences between Clinton and Cornwallis now brought disaster to the British and Loyalist cause. Cornwallis had long chafed under Clinton's instructions, which tethered him to his base at Charleston. Clinton judged that the holding of South Carolina was the main object of the war in the South, and that any inland excursion depended on naval control of the coast. Cornwallis, on the other hand, was eager to press forward. He maintained that the American guerrillas in North Carolina prevented any effective occupation of the South, and until and unless they were subdued, the British would have to retire within the walls of Charleston. He held that Virginia was the heart and centre of the Patriot cause, and that all efforts should be concentrated on its conquest and occupation. The first step, therefore, was to overrun North Carolina. There is no doubt he was wrong. Charleston, not Virginia, was the military key to the South. It was the only southern port of any consequence, and the only place from which he could receive supplies for himself and deny them to the rebels. From here, he could not only dominate the state of Georgia to the south, but by establishing small posts in North Carolina and at Chesapeake Bay, keep up the appearance, as Washington wrote at the time, of possessing 400 miles upon the coast, and of consequence have a pretext for setting up claims which may be very detrimental to the interest of America in European councils. But Cornwallis's military reputation had been in the ascendant since the Battle of Camden, and he was encouraged by the British government to proceed with his plans, which largely depended for their success on the Southern Loyalists. In spite of their unpromising behaviour in the previous campaign, and in spite of the nomination of Washington's ablest general, Nathaniel Greene, to command the Patriot forces in the South, Cornwallis resolved to advance. Thus, he marched to destruction. In January 1781, he moved towards the borders of North Carolina. His forward detachments clashed with the Americans at Cowpens on the morning of the 17th. The British tactics were simple and costly. Cornwallis had experienced the marksmanship of the American frontiersmen, and knew the inefficiency in musketry of his own troops. He therefore relied on sabre and bayonet charges. The American commander had placed his ill-organized and ill-disciplined militia with the broad river behind them to stop them dispersing. Washington always doubted the value of these troops, and had declared that no militia would ever acquire the habits necessary to resist a regular force. But this time, stiffened by Continental troops, they mauled the British. Cornwallis, nevertheless, pressed on. He was now far from his base, and Greene's army was still in the field. His only hope was to bring Greene to battle and destroy him. They met at Guilford Courthouse on March the 15th. The American militia proved useless, but the trained nucleus of Greene's troops drawn up behind a rail fence wrought havoc among the British regulars. Again and again, headed by their officers, the regiments assaulted the American line. An English sergeant who kept a journal of the campaign thus describes the scene. "Instantly the movement was made, in excellent order, in a smart run with arms charged. When arrived within 40 yards of the enemy's line, it was perceived that this whole force had their weapons presented and resting on a rail fence, the common partitions in America. They were taking aim with nicest precision." In the end, this devoted and disciplined bravery drove the Americans from the field, but the slaughter was indecisive. The Patriot force was still active, while the British were far from home and had lost nearly a third of their men. Cornwallis had no choice but to make for the coast and seek reinforcements from the Navy. Greene let him go. His army had done enough. In just under 8 months, they'd marched and fought over 900 miles of swampy and desolate country. Outnumbered by 3-1, he'd reconquered the whole of Georgia except Savannah, and all but a small portion of South Carolina. He lost the battles, but he won the campaign. Abandoning the wide spaces of North Carolina, he now moved swiftly southwards to raise the country against the British. Here, the fierce civil war in progress between Patriots and Loyalists, or Whigs and Tories as they were locally called, was darkened by midnight raids, seizure of cattle, murders, ambushes, and atrocities such as we have known in our own day in Ireland. Greene himself wrote, "The animosities between the Whigs and Tories of this state, South Carolina, renders their situation truly deplorable. There is not a day passes, but there are more or less who fall a sacrifice to this savage disposition. The Whigs seem determined to extirpate the Tories, and the Tories the Whigs. Some thousands have fallen in this way in this quarter, and the evil rages with more violence than ever. If a stop cannot be put to these massacres, the country will be depopulated in a few months more, as neither Whig nor Tory can live. While Greene began to subdue the isolated British posts in South Carolina, Cornwallis continued his advance to Virginia. He devastated the countryside in his march, but was fiercely and skillfully harried by Lafayette and a meager patriot band. Throughout these months, Clinton lay in New York, and as Cornwallis drew nearer, it seemed possible that Clinton might evacuate the northern base and concentrate the whole British effort on preserving the hold on the southern colonies. This, if it had succeeded, might have wrecked the patriot cause, for the Congress was bankrupt and Washington could scarcely keep his army together. But once again, the French fleet turned the scales, this time forever. The desperate situation of the Americans was revealed to the French naval commander in the West Indies, de Grasse. In July, he sent word to Washington, who had now been joined at White Plains by Rochambeau from Newport, that he would attack the Virginian coast. He called for a supreme effort to concentrate the whole Patriot force in this region. Washington seized the opportunity. Taking elaborate precautions to deceive Clinton, he withdrew his troops from the Hudson and, united with Rochambeau, marched quickly southwards. Cornwallis, in the meantime, starved of supplies and with ever-lengthening lines of communication, marched to the coast, where he hoped to make direct contact with Clinton by sea. In August, he arrived at Yorktown on Chesapeake Bay and began to dig himself in. His conduct in the following months has been much criticized. He had no natural defense on the land side of the town, and he made little effort to strike at the enemies gathering around him. The Franco-American strategy was a feat of timing, and the convergence of force was carried out over vast distances. Nearly 9,000 Americans and 8,000 French assembled before Yorktown, while de Grasse blockaded the coast with 40 ships of the line. For nearly 2 months, Cornwallis sat and waited. At the end of September, the investment of Yorktown began, and the bombardment of the French siege artillery shattered his earth redoubts. Cornwallis planned a desperate sortie as the defences crumbled. At the end, one British cannon remained in action. On October the 17th, 1781, the whole army, about 7,000 strong, surrendered. On the very same day, Clinton and the British squadron sailed from New York, but on hearing of the disaster, they turned back. Thus ended the main struggle. Sea power had once more decided the issue, and but for the French blockade, the British war of attrition might well have succeeded. In November, his task accomplished, de Grasse returned to the West Indies, and Washington was left unaided to face Clinton in New York and the menace of invasion from Canada. 2 years were to pass before peace came to America, but no further military operations of any consequence took place. The surrender at Yorktown had immediate and decisive effects in England. When the news was brought to Lord North, his amiable composure slid from him. He paced his room, exclaiming in agonized tones, "Oh God, it is all over." The opposition gathered strongly in the Commons. There were riotous meetings in London. The government majority collapsed on a motion censuring the administration of the Navy. An address to stop the American war was rejected by a single vote. In March, North informed the Commons that he would resign. "At last the fatal day has come," wrote the King. North maintained his dignity to the last. After 12 years of service, he left the House of Commons a beaten man. As the members stood waiting in the rain for their carriages on that March evening in 1782, they saw North come down the steps and get into his own vehicle, which had been forewarned and was waiting at the head of the line. With a courtly bow to the drenched and hostile members crowding round him, he said, "That, gentlemen, is the advantage of being in the secret," and drove quickly away. King George, in the agony of personal defeat, showed greater passion. He talked of abdication and retiring to Hanover. The violent feeling in the country denied him all hope of holding a successful election. he was forced to come to terms with the opposition. Through the long years of the American War, Rockingham and Burke had waited in patience for the collapse of North's administration. Now their chance had come. Rockingham made his terms with the king. Independence for the colonies and some lessening of the crown's influence in politics. George III was forced to accept, and Rockingham took office. It fell to him and his colleague, Lord Shelburne, to save what they could from the wreckage of the first British Empire. Chapter 9. The Indian Empire. The 18th century saw a revolutionary change in the British position in India. The English East India Company, founded simply as a trading venture, grew with increasing speed into a vast territorial empire. About the year 1700, probably no more than 1,500 English people dwelt in India, including wives, children, and transient seamen. They lived apart in a handful of factories, as their trading stations were called, little concerned with Indian politics. 100 years later, British officials and soldiers in their thousands, under a British Governor-General, were in control of extensive provinces. This remarkable development was in part a result of the struggle between Britain and France, which filled the age and was fought out all over the globe. In America, the French had the satisfaction of helping the United States to independence. In that field, Britain was worsted. It was otherwise in India, where often the fight went on when in Europe Britain and France were at peace. But the Anglo-French conflict would never have spread violently across India if the times had not been ripe for European intervention. The great empire of the Mughals was disintegrating. For 2 centuries, these Muslim descendants of Tamerlane had gripped and pacified a portion of the world half as large as the present United States. Centred in Delhi and supported by able proconsuls, they'd kept the peace in Oriental fashion and conferred on the 80 million inhabitants of the subcontinent an orderly existence which they were not to know again for another 100 years. Early in the 18th century, this formidable dynasty was shaken by a disputed succession. Invaders from the north soon poured across the frontiers. Delhi was sacked by the Shah of Persia. The viceroys of the Mughals revolted and laid claim to the sovereignty of the imperial provinces. Pretenders rose up to challenge the usurpers. In central India, the fierce fighting tribes of the Maharathas, bound in a loose confederacy, saw and seized their chance to loot and to raid. The country was swept by anarchy and bloodshed. Hitherto, European traders in India, English, French, Portuguese, and Dutch, had plied their wares in rivalry, but so long as the great Mughal ruled in Delhi, they'd competed in comparative peace and safety. The English East India Company had grown into a solid affair, with a capital of over £1.25 million and an annual dividend of 9%. The population of Bombay, which Charles II had leased to the company for £10 a year in 1668, had multiplied more than sixfold and exceeded 60,000 souls. Madras, founded and fortified by the British in 1640, was the chief trading centre on the eastern coast. Calcutta, uninhabited till the servants of the corporation built a factory on the banks of the Hooghly River in 1686, had become a flourishing and peaceful emporium. The French Compagnie des Indes, centred at Pondicherry, had also prospered, though, unlike its British rival, it was in effect a department of state and not a private concern. Both organisations had the same object, the promotion of commerce and the gaining of financial profit. The acquisition of territory played little part in the thoughts and plans of either nation, and indeed, the English directors had long been reluctant to own any land or assume any responsibilities beyond the confines of their trading stations. About 1740, events forced them to change their tune. The Maharathas slaughtered the Nawab, or imperial governor, of the Carnatic, the 500-mile-long province on the southeastern coast. They threatened Madras and Bombay and raided the depths of Bengal. It was becoming impossible for the European traders to stand aside. They must either fight on their own, or in alliance with Indian rulers, or quit. Most of the Dutch had already withdrawn to the rich archipelago of the East Indies. The Portuguese had long since fallen behind in the race. The French and English resolved to stay. Thus these two European powers were left alone in the field. As has so often happened in the great crises of her history, France produced a man. Joseph Dupleix, governor of Pondicherry since 1742, had long foreseen the coming struggle with Britain. He perceived that India awaited a new ruler. The Mughal Empire was at an end, and a Maharatta Empire seemed unlikely to replace it. Why, then, should not France seize this glittering, fertile prize? When the War of the Austrian Succession broke out in Europe, Dupleix acted with decision. He appealed to the new Nawab of the Carnatic to forbid hostilities within his jurisdiction, where most of the French stations lay. This granted, he proceeded to attack Madras. Its English governor asked the Nawab to enforce a similar neutrality on the French, but omitted to accompany his request with a suitable bribe. Dupleix, on the other hand, promised to hand over the city once it was captured. Thus reassured, the Nawab stood aside, and after a 5-day bombardment, the town surrendered on September 10, 1746. Some of its British defenders escaped to the nearby Fort St. David. Among them was a young clerk of 21 named Robert Clive. Dupleix, victorious, refused to surrender Madras to the Nawab and spent the rest of the year repelling his attacks. He then assaulted Fort St. David, but news arrived that the war in Europe had ceased and that the peace treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle prescribed that Madras was to be returned to the British in return for the cession of Louisbourg in Nova Scotia to France. Thus ended a dismal and inglorious opening to the great struggle in India. Clive had watched these events with anger and alarm, but hitherto there had been few signs in his career to mark him as the man who would reverse his country's fortunes and found the rule of the British in India. He was the son of a small squire, and his boyhood had been variegated and unpromising. Clive had attended no fewer than 4 schools and been unsuccessful at all. In his Shropshire market town, he'd organized and led a gang of adolescent ruffians who extorted pennies and apples from tradesmen in return for not breaking their windows. At the age of 18, he was sent abroad as a junior clerk in the East India Company at a salary of £5 a year and £40 expenses. He was a difficult and unpromising subordinate. He detested the routine and the atmosphere of the counting house. Twice, it is said, he attempted suicide, and twice the pistol misfired. Not until he'd obtained a military commission and served some years in the armed forces of the company did he reveal a military genius unequalled in the British history of India. The siege of Madras and the defence of Fort St. David had given him a taste for fighting. In 1748, a new upheaval gave him the chance of leadership. Indian pretenders seized the Mughal viceroyalty of the Deccan and conquered the Carnatic. With a few French soldiers and a couple of thousand Indian troops, Dupleix expelled them and placed his own puppets on the throne. The British candidate, Muhammad Ali, was chased into Trichinopoly and fiercely besieged. At a stroke, France had become master of southern India. The next blow would obviously be against the English. Here was the end of any hope of peaceful trading, or of what would nowadays be called non-intervention in Indian affairs, and it became evident that the East India Company must either fight or die. Clive obtained a commission. He made his way to Trichinopoly and saw for himself that Muhammad Ali was in desperate peril. If he could be rescued and placed on the throne, all might be well. But how to do it? Trichinopoly was beset by a combined French and Indian army of vast numbers. The English had very few soldiers and were so ill-prepared and so short of officers that Clive, still only 25, was given the chief military command. The direct relief of Trichinopoly was impossible, and Clive at once perceived that his blow must be struck elsewhere. Arcot, capital of the Carnatic, had been stripped of troops. Most of them were at Trichinopoly, besieging Muhammad Ali. Capture Arcot, and they would be forced to come back. With 200 Europeans, 600 Indians, and 8 officers, of whom half were former clerks like himself, Clive set forth. The town fell easily to his assault, and he and his small handful prepared desperately for the vengeance which was to come. Everything turned out as Clive had foreseen. The Indian potentate, dismayed by the loss of his capital, detached a large portion of his troops from Trichinopoly and attacked Clive in Arcot. The struggle lasted for 50 days. 20 times outnumbered and close to starvation, Clive's puny force broke the onslaught in a night attack, in which he served a gun himself, and the siege was lifted by the threat of an admiring Mahratta chieftain to come to the aid of the British. This was the end of Dupleix, and of much else besides. By 1752, Clive, in combination with Stringer Lawrence, a regular soldier from England, had defeated the French and the French-sponsored usurpers, and placed Muhammad Ali on the throne. The Carnatic was safe. Next year, Clive, newly wed but in bad health, sailed to England. He was much enriched by the presents, as they were politely called, which he had received from Indian rulers. Dupleix struggled on, but was recalled to France in 1754, and died 9 years later in poverty and disgrace. The contrast is striking between the wealth and power won by the English leaders in India and the sad fate that befell most of the French. In England, Clive used a part of his fortune in an attempt to enter Parliament for a rotten borough in Cornwall. He was unsuccessful, and in 1755 he returned to India. He was only just in time, for a new struggle was about to open in the northeast. Hitherto, French, Dutch, and English had traded peacefully side by side in the fertile province of Bengal, and its docile, intelligent, and industrious inhabitants had largely escaped the slaughter and anarchy of the south. Calcutta, at the mouth of the Ganges, was earning good dividends. Peace had been kept by a Muslim adventurer from the northwest who'd seized and held power for 14 years. But he died in 1756, and the throne passed to his grandson, Suraj Ad Dowlah, young, vicious, violent, and greedy. Fearing, with some justice, that what came to be called the 7 Years' War between Britain and France, lately broken out, would engulf his dominions and reduce him to a puppet like his fellow princes in the Deccan, he called on both the European communities to dismantle their fortifications. The French, at Chandernagore, upriver from Calcutta, returned a soothing answer. The English, aware that war with France was imminent, had extended their fortifications on the river bank, where the French attack was expected, and ignored his demands. Other frictions increased his anger. In May, Suraj Ad Dowlah struck. Gathering a large army, including guns and Europeans trained to use them, he marched on Calcutta. Modern research has cleared the governor and the English authorities from the graver charges of cowardice and incompetence denounced by Macaulay, but the landward approach to the city was unfortified. There was mismanagement and confusion, and the evacuation by ships developed into a panic scramble. The small garrison and most of the English civilians fought bravely, but in 3 days it was all over. They had lived in peace too long. A terrible fate now overtook them. 146 Europeans surrendered, after the enemy had penetrated the defences, under a flag of truce. They were thrust for the night into a prison cell, 20 feet square. By the morning, all except 23 were dead. The victors departed, having looted the company's possessions. "Little though he guessed it," says Lord Elton, "the dealings of Suraj Ad Dowlah with the British had ensured they would become the next rulers of India. For the tragedy of the Black Hole had dispelled their last wishful illusion that it might still be possible for them to remain in India as traders and no more. There was an outrage to avenge, and at last they were more than ready to fight." The news reached Madras in August. The directors had not yet learnt that war with France had already broken out in Europe, but there were rumours, as in Calcutta, of a French attack both by sea and from the Deccan. They nevertheless gave Clive all their naval power and nearly all their troops. In January 1757, with 900 European and 1,500 Indian soldiers, he recaptured Calcutta and repulsed Suraj Ad Dowlah's army of 40,000 men. The war with France now compelled him to retreat, but only long enough for him to attack Chandernagore, which he dared not leave in French hands, before hastening back to Madras. In March, Chandernagore fell. Its garrison, fighting very bravely, withdrew. Then fortune came to Clive's aid. Suraj Ad Dowlah's cruelty was too much, even for his own people. A group of courtiers resolved to depose him and place a new ruler, Mir Jaffar, on the throne. Clive agreed to help. On June the 23rd, his army, having grown to 3,000 men, of whom less than a third were British, he met Suraj Ad Dowlah at Plassey. He was outnumbered 17-1. The Hooghly River, now in flood behind him, forbade retreat. The enemy gathered in a semicircle on the open plain. Clive disposed his force along the edge of a mango grove and awaited the onslaught. Battle there was none. Nevertheless, it was a trial of strength on which the fortunes of India turned. For 4 hours there was a cannonade. Then Suraj Ad Dowlah, sensing treachery in his own camp, and listening to the counsel of those plotting to betray him, ordered a withdrawal. Clive had resolved to let him go and make a night attack later on, but a junior officer advanced against orders. It became impossible to check the pursuit. The enemy dispersed in panic, and a few days later Suraj Ad Dowlah was murdered by Mir Jaffar's son. For the loss of 36 men, Clive had become the master of Bengal and the victor of Plassey. Much, however, still remained to be accomplished. Mir Jaffar, who'd taken no part in the so-called battle, was placed on the throne. But the province swarmed with Muslim fighting men from the north and was fertile in pretenders. The neighbouring state of Oude was hostile. The French were still active, and even the Dutch showed signs of interfering. Clive beat the lot. If the English would not rule the country themselves, they must ensure that a friendly local potentate did so. Indirect control was the order of the day. The alternative was more anarchy and more bloodshed. When Clive sailed once more to England in February 1760, Britain was the only European power left in India. In little more than 4 years, he'd brought about a great change upon the Indian scene. The French were still allowed to keep their trading posts, but their influence was destroyed, and 9 years later, the Compagnie des Indes was abolished. Clive had now accumulated a fortune of £250,000. He bought his way into Parliament, as was the custom of the time, and was created an Irish peer. His services in India were not yet over. Modern generations should not mistake the character of the British expansion in India. The government was never involved as a principal in the Indian conflict, and while Pitt, who justly appreciated the ability of Clive, supported him with all the resources at his command, his influence on events was small. In any case, he already had a world war on his hands. Faced with the difficulties of communication, the distance, and the complexities of the scene, Pitt left Clive with a free hand, contenting himself with advice and support. The East India Company was a trading organization. Its directors were men of business. They wanted dividends, not wars, and grudged every penny spent on troops and annexations. But the turmoil in the great subcontinent compelled them, against their will and their judgment, to take control of more and more territory, till in the end, and almost by accident, they established an empire no less solid and certainly more peaceful than that of their Mughal predecessors. To call this process imperialist expansion is nonsense, if by that is meant the deliberate acquisition of political power. Of India, it has been well said that the British Empire was acquired in a fit of absence of mind. Clive's triumph created as many problems as it solved, and the years which followed his departure contain some of the most squalid pages in the history of the British in India. The object of the East India Company was to make profits. How the country was ruled, they neither knew nor cared, so long as peace was maintained and trade prospered. They deposed the aging Mir Jaffer, and when his puppet successor became restless, defeated him in a bloody battle, and sold the throne of Bengal by auction. The ill-paid servants of the company were both forced and encouraged to take bribes, presents, and every kind of shameful perquisite from the inhabitants. Tales of corruption and the gaining of vast and illicit private fortunes crept back to England. The directors of the company suddenly found that they had lost both their dividends and their good name. They appealed to Clive, again made him governor of Bengal and commander-in-chief, and in June 1764 he sailed to India for the last time. His reforms were drastic, high-handed, and in effect more far-reaching than the victory at Plessy. Their success prompted the Mughal emperor to invite him to extend a British protectorate to Delhi and all northern India. Clive refused. He'd long doubted the ability of the company to undertake the larger responsibilities of empire, and 5 years earlier he'd suggested in a letter to Pitt that the Crown should assume the sovereignty of the company's possessions in India. This advice was disregarded for nearly a century. Meanwhile, in return for a subsidy, the great mogul ceded to the company the right to administer the revenues. Administration of justice remained with the Indian rulers. Such division of responsibilities could not last, and was soon to create formidable problems, but at least it was a step forward. "The British held the purse strings, and the power," wrote Clive, "is now lodged where it can only be lodged in safety." In January 1767 he returned to England. The British public were critical and ill-informed. Clive was assailed in the House of Commons. He defended himself in an eloquent speech. He pointed out that by his exertions the directors of the East India Company had acquired an empire more extensive than any kingdom in Europe. They had acquired a revenue of 4 million sterling and trade in proportion. About the gains which he himself had made, he exclaimed in a celebrated passage, "Am I not rather deserving of praise for the moderation which marked my proceedings? Consider the situation in which the victory at Plassey had placed me. A great prince was dependent on my pleasure, an opulent city lay at my mercy, its richest bankers bid against each other for my smiles. I walked through vaults which were thrown open to me alone, piled on either hand with gold and jewels. Mr. Chairman, at this moment I stand astonished at my own moderation." The House of Commons unanimously passed a resolution that "Robert Lord Clive rendered great and meritorious services to this country." The vehement, tormented spirit who was the subject of this motion was not appeased. A few years later he died by his own hand. Clive was soon followed in India by as great a man as himself, but with a somewhat different background. Warren Hastings was poor, but his ancestors had once owned large estates in Worcestershire. The wars of Oliver Cromwell had compelled his great-grandfather to sell the family home at Daylesford, and from early boyhood Hastings dreamed of winning it back. His mother died when he was very young, and an uncle brought him up and sent him to school at Westminster. There he became the senior classical scholar, and the masters wanted him to go to a university. His uncle refused, and sent him to India instead. He was then 16 years of age. He served the East India Company as a subordinate through the great period of Clive's triumphs, and a year after Clive's final departure he became a member of the council in Calcutta. From this position of limited but definite responsibility, he witnessed the squalor and confusion which prevailed. The company's servants continued to build their fortunes at the expense of their employers and of the inhabitants. The Maharathas seized Delhi and menaced Oudh. Madras was threatened, and even Bombay, hitherto so peaceful, was involved in the civil wars. Between 1769 and 1770, a third of the population of Bengal died of famine. Throughout these ordeals, Warren Hastings held fast to an austere way of life. He desired fame and power and enough money to buy back Daylesford. The gathering of private fortunes he left to others. Rapacity was not in his nature. In 1772, he became governor of the stricken, preyed-upon, but still wealthy province of Bengal. He made two resolutions: to keep up the company's dividends and to make the British collect the taxes. By now, however, the whispers and worse on which Clive had been nearly censured by Parliament had taken hold of public opinion in England. Rich adventurers from the East were making and marring the repute of the new empire in India. Too wealthy and too arrogant to subside into the levels of society from which they'd emerged, and too upsprung to mix with the aristocracy, the Nabobs, as they were called, it is the same word as Nawab but in different spelling, were disliked or envied by all classes in Great Britain. The courage and discipline which had won the day at Arcot and at Plassey and had avenged the Black Hole were overlooked. Nor was this wholly unjust, since many of the Nabobs had been too busily engaged on amassing wealth to lend much help to Clive. "India," declared the aging Chatham, "teems with iniquities so rank as to smell to heaven and earth." Jealousy, ignorance, and sentimentality combined in a cry for reform. There were also solid grounds for complaint. Within 9 years, nearly £3 million had been collected as personal rewards by the company's servants from the inhabitants of Bengal. The instrument for reform happened to be Lord North. North did his best within his lights. His motto was Shackle the Great, and the year after Hastings became governor of Bengal, he induced Parliament to pass a regulating act. The measure was not totally lacking in merit. The administration of British-held territory in India was unified. Bombay and Madras were subjected to a Governor-General established at Calcutta, and Warren Hastings was made the first Governor-General, with a salary of £25,000 a year. But in trying to make sure that power was not abused, it was made impotent. On paper, it was divided between the Nawab of Bengal, the Board of Directors, the Governor-General, and a council appointed to veto and control him. For years, Hastings fought against his shackles. His principal opponent was his new colleague, Philip Francis, the reputed author of the savage Letters of Junius, which had attacked the government at home during the agitations over Wilkes. Francis never ceased to intrigue against him, openly and behind his back. But Hastings knew what needed to be done, and he was determined to do it. Though naturally a man of quick temper, he learned the virtues of patience and cool persistence. At one moment, the government tried to recall him. Then two of the most ignorant and hostile members of his council died, and soon afterwards France, roused by the revolt in America and seeking to regain her power in India, once again declared war on Britain. Hastings, at last, was free to act. His liberation came only just in time. By 1778, a French fleet was approaching the southern coast. Hyder Ali of Mysore was overrunning the Carnatic. The British governor of Madras had been imprisoned by his own corrupt officials, and Bombay was at war with the Mahrattas. In the space of 6 years, Hastings retrieved everything. His naval forces were weaker than the French, and although they fought no fewer than 5 engagements, they were unable to prevent the French landing on the Madras coast. The government of Madras was purged and reanimated. Sir Eyre Coote, who'd served at Plassey and was still the ablest British soldier in India, was sent hurriedly southwards. He defeated Hyder Ali at Porto Novo in 1781, and his son, Tipu Sultan, a year later. Peace was negotiated with the Mahrattas. By 1783, the only active enemies who remained were the French, and their hopes of progress were stopped by the conclusion of the Treaty of Versailles. England had lost one empire in America and gained another in India. All this train of action had cost a lot of money. Hastings could get very little help, financial or material, from England, exhausted and overstrained by the conflict in America, Europe, and on the seas. His only course was to raise it on the spot. The inhabitants of Bengal were wealthy. They were also, thanks to British arms and leadership, comparatively safe. They should pay for their protection, and Hastings had been quite ruthless in making them do so. Thus he gathered the funds to rescue Bombay and the Carnatic, and to stop the bloodshed once more engulfing Bengal. His critics, and those of the East India Company, were not slow to point out that only a third of the £2 million he raised was spent on the war. The rest leaked away in familiar directions. But Hastings himself was careless of money and came home with no great fortune. He left India in 1785, not without the gratitude of the inhabitants. Unlike many Englishmen in India at this time, he spoke the local languages well. He enjoyed the society of Indians, and had once been rebuked on this account by the formidable Clive. Though proud of his birth and ancestry, consciousness of race, colour, or religion never influenced or distracted him. In the beginning, Hastings was welcomed and honoured in England. His achievements and victories were some compensation for the humiliations and disasters in America, and the company had much to thank him for. A year before his return, the younger Pitt had passed an India Act, making the Board of Control subject to a cabinet which assumed the political powers of the East India Company. Hastings had disapproved of this. Though the Governor-General was thus freed from the fetters of the Council at Calcutta, imposed by North's ill-conceived measure, patronage passed into the hands of Pitt's friend and adviser, Henry Dundas, appointed President of the Board of Control. In fact, a flow of ambitious, earnest, and incorrupt young Scotsmen started to fill and fortify the British administrative posts in India, where, thanks to Clive and to Hastings, most of them could now gain a living without taking bribes and pickings. All this was very good. But not so easily did Parliament forget the rank iniquities which Chatham had denounced. The nabobs in England were still obtrusive, vulgar, and ostentatiously wealthy. Soon after Hastings' return, a parliamentary inquiry into his conduct had been set on foot. No personal charge of corruption could be proved against him, but he was arrogant and tactless in his dealings with the politicians of all parties. Headed by Burke, Fox, and Sheridan, Parliament resolved to have his blood. Philip Francis, whom he'd wounded in a duel in Calcutta, malignly urged his enemies on. The ancient weapon of impeachment was resurrected and turned against him. The trial opened in Westminster Hall on February the 13th, 1788. It lasted over 7 years. Every aspect and detail of Hastings' administration was scrutinized, denounced, upheld, misunderstood, or applauded. At the end, he was acquitted. Though much of the uproar was unfair and uncomprehending, the proceedings proclaimed to the public and to the world the support of the British people for Burke's declaration that India should be governed by those laws which are to be found in Europe, Africa, and Asia, that are found amongst all mankind, those principles of equity and humanity implanted in our hearts, which have their existence in the feelings of mankind that are capable of judging. Hastings was nearly bankrupt by the cost of defending himself. The company, however, had given him enough money to buy back Daylesford, and many years later, when testifying in the Commons on Indian affairs, the House uncovered in his honour. He never held office again. But at any rate, he was more fortunate than his old opponents from France, several of whom had long before been beheaded or made penniless. Posterity has redeemed his name from the slurs of the Whigs. It is convenient at this point to look ahead in the story of British India. The Napoleonic Wars were accompanied by a vast extension of British power. On the eve of the Revolution in France, the rule of the East India Company was confined to the province of Bengal and to a few coastal strips around the ports of Madras and Bombay. By the morrow of Waterloo, it embraced all except the northwesterly portions of the subcontinent. The impeachment of Warren Hastings was a turning point in the history of the British in India. The chief power was no longer to be grasped by obscure, brilliant servants of the company who could seize and merit it, and the post of Governor-General was henceforward occupied by personages distinguished on their own account and drawn from the leading families in England. The Marquess Cornwallis, uncowed by the surrender at Yorktown, the Marquess Wellesley, Lord Minto, the Marquess of Hastings, Lord William Bentinck, and Lord Dalhousie. In effect, though not in name, these men were viceroys, untempted by the hope of financial gain, impatient of restraint by ill-informed governments in London, and sufficiently intimate with the ruling circles in Britain to do what they thought right and without fear of the consequences. And indeed, there'd been much for them to do. The Carnatic, hinterland of Madras, was presided over in 1785 by an Indian Nawab supported by British arms and British money. The state of Mysore, stretching to the western coast, had been seized from a Hindu dynasty by Hyder Ali, and was heartily misgoverned by his son Tipu Sultan, who coveted the domination of all southern India. In the south-central portion of the peninsula, the Nizam of Hyderabad ruled feebly over the Deccan, unreliable for keeping order, and in theory a vassal of the puppet emperor in Delhi. Beyond all these swarmed the Maharathas, a confederacy of military families, fierce Hindu fighting men, lightly armed and mounted on swift horses, who could disperse, as speedily as they attacked, ancient opponents of the Mahometan Moguls, and avid to found an Indian empire of their own. Bengal alone lay peacefully in the British grip, precariously shielded from the turmoil by the weak buffer state of Oude. Cornwallis was soon compelled to deal with Tipu. In the last decade of the 18th century, he marched against him, captured most of Mysore, and made him surrender half his territory. Cornwallis's successor, a nonentity who came to power in the same year as Louis XVI was beheaded, tried to call a halt, but Indian rulers were now taking French officers into their pay and training their armies on the European pattern. The Marquess Wellesley was left in 1798 to extinguish the threat. Napoleon, victorious in Egypt, and himself seeking an empire in the East, offered help to Tipu, who began to assemble a French-trained army. The struggle between France and England once again loomed over India. There was a danger of naval attack from the French-held island of Mauritius in the Indian Ocean. Wellesley acted with speed and resolution. He offered Tipu what was termed a subsidiary treaty, whereby Tipu was to dismiss all Frenchmen, disband his troops, and pay for the company's protection of his dominions. Tipu preferred to fight, and in 1799 he was driven back to his capital at Seringapatam and killed. Wellesley then annexed the outlying portions of Mysore and returned the rest to the Hindu potentates whom Hyder Ali had dispossessed. They did not survive for long. When the French Oriental ambitions foundered in the Battle of the Nile, Wellesley turned his attention to the Carnatic. Its government was bankrupt and oppressive, and in 1801 he pensioned off the Nawab and made it into the Madras Presidency. In the same year, he dealt with Oude. Here all was far from well. The Nawab, though under British protection, had surrendered his dominions to pillage and exploitation by his own mutinous troops and by greedy adventurers from Europe. On him also Wellesley imposed a subsidiary treaty. In return for a guarantee of protection, he ceded half his territories to the British, dismissed all Europeans from his service except those approved by the company, and promised to govern according to the company's advice. Lastly, Wellesley dealt with the Maharathas. Some years previously, they'd captured Delhi, seized the person of the Mughal emperor, and demanded tribute on his behalf from Bengal. Now they started fighting among themselves. Their chief escaped and appealed to Wellesley, who restored him to his capital at Pune. The rest of them thereupon declared war on the British, and after heavy fighting were defeated at Assaye and elsewhere by Wellesley's younger brother, the future Duke of Wellington. On them also Wellesley imposed a subsidiary treaty, and Orissa and most of the province of Delhi were surrendered to the British. In 7 years, writes a distinguished historian, he transformed the map of India and launched his countrymen on a career of expansion which only stopped at the Afghan mountains half a century later. These proceedings appear, superficially, ambitious and high-handed in the extreme. For their justification, they must plead that in every case they operated to the advantage of the populations concerned. 18th-century India resembled 5th-century Europe. Wellesley knew that British rule was the only alternative to bloodshed, tyranny, and anarchy, and he had no false delicacy in translating his conviction into fact. Europe, after the fall of Rome, took many weary centuries to settle down into a land where the common man might live his life in security. In India, British authority accomplished a settlement in the space of 50 years. The East India Company, however, took a different view. The directors still wanted trade, not conquests, and were so hostile and critical that Wellesley was recalled in 1805. His successor, Lord Minto, was expressly forbidden